This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Florida lawmakers have agreed on exactly how they'll pay out the state's millions of dollars for damages sustained from BP's 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Coming up in the second half of our show, we'll talk to a reporter who's been tracking the tussle in Tallahassee. But first, an executive order signed by the administration of President Donald Trump in late April could expand oil and gas exploration in the Gulf of Mexico, including long-protected portions of the eastern Gulf off of Florida's coast. Trump's executive order directs Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to review an Obama-era ban on offshore oil and gas exploration in the Gulf, the Arctic, and the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. But the Eastern Gulf has been protected for years through a bipartisan group in Congress led by longtime Florida Senator Bill Nelson banning exploration in the region through the year 2022. Here to talk about what Trump's executive order could mean for Florida and specifically the petroleum industry in our state is Florida Petroleum Council Executive Director David Mica. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Good afternoon, Joy. Good to be with you and your listeners.
Also joining the program is Jacqueline Lopez, the Florida Director and Staff Attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We are talking about oil and gas drilling in the Gulf of Mexico and what it could mean for Florida industries like energy, tourism, and more. Give us a call with your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCO. First, David Mica with the Florida Petroleum Council. We're talking here about the ban on the Eastern Gulf through 2022 and the Trump administration's ordering of a new review of oil and gas leases along all of the nation's coast. Can you tell us what kind of oil and gas exploration is allowed right now in the Gulf?
Well, currently we are allowed to explore and produce, Julie, in the western section of the Gulf, the central portion of the Gulf, and actually we are allowed to produce in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, too. So it's a misnomer to say that there is a ban on exploration and production in the eastern Gulf of Mexico. However, it's only about 2% of that eastern Gulf of Mexico area. And 98% of the Eastern Gulf is off limits under a congressional moratorium until 2022.
Okay, so only 2% of the Eastern Gulf area is not possible.
That's 2%.
2% is okay. 98% of it is is fully banned. So, what would the Florida petroleum industry want to see happen from the Trump administration's proposal to reexamine oil and gas exploration out there?
Well, first, we should state that we're encouraged by the president following up on his campaign rhetoric associated with increasing access to the federal offshore acreage for development. 94% of America's coastline is off limits, and we talked about the eastern Gulf of Mexico. And despite we've been producing offshore almost 65 years. And that history is pretty darn good in the Gulf of Mexico, and it produces about 1.4 million barrels of oil per day and 3.1 billion cubic feet of natural gas per day. And that's very, very important to our nation's energy mix and energy production for the United States in making us more secure and energy independent.
What percent is that of the whole that is produced in the United States?
So it is in the 25% range, 20 to 25% in oil, and it's in that area as well. Onshore production, as a result of hydraulic fracturing, has it greatly increased as well. So that has changed that mix a bit also. And then certainly since the Macondo incident, oil production in the Gulf of Mexico was initially reduced, but it is moving back in a very positive direction to surpass production levels historically thought available.
Okay. So Jacqueline Lopez with the Center for Biological Diversity, for our listeners who aren't familiar with your organization, can you tell me a little bit about what your group does and where it stands on the reopening of America's coast to offshore drilling?
Thank you. Yeah, the center is an environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting and conserving endangered species. And so our position with respect to opening the eastern Gulf of Mexico is that it would just be foolish, given the resources that we have to protect in Florida and off of our coast, from our communities to our environment to the people and our wildlife to Florida's over $1 billion tourism economy. It just doesn't make any sense to put our coast at risk.
Mm-hmm. So I want to put one question back to David. So far, we have 100 cities and towns in Gulf states that have passed resolutions against offshore drilling. How far do those rights extend? For example, so like if the city of Naples, for example, wanted to put a moratorium on offshore drilling, how far out do their rights go?
Well, the city of Naples has no rights there. The state controls on the western portion of the Gulf, the first 8.8 miles or so, and then the federal Outer Continental Lands Act protects in as far as the economic exclusive zone of the United States out to about 200 miles. Let me just also mention, I can't hear your other guests, so I'm a little in the dark of the other portion of the conversation. If you're technical folks,
I was just made aware of that, and I will be sure to try to summarize and pass along, and I will phrase things accordingly so that I make sure you're in the loop there. But I wanted
the city's resolution is as far as offshore, they have no jurisdiction whatsoever there, and the resolutions that you speak of are from across the nation, and the nation is much more than those towns that have passed a resolution or such. And virtually all of those are done without a full examination of the issues associated with that, without any interaction from folks that would be interested in the issue with industry input and scientific input. Really just a group of activists that typically will go to a city or a county commissioner and ask for a resolution, and they do one knowing that it is not something that they have jurisdiction over.
Well, it's kind of, I guess, more symbolic but lacks teeth. How far out do a state's rights go into the water?
As we were talking about on the state side, in the Florida area, we have jurisdiction out to about 8 miles. And the other states along the Gulf Coast, it's shorter distance. And then on the Atlantic side, we have out as far as 8 miles or the Gulf Stream, whichever is closer to shore, as far as our state jurisdiction. And those are things that our folks in Tallahassee would be able to have jurisdiction over. So you're talking about, really, when you talk about oil and gas exploration, you're talking about three kind of sectors. That onshore, which, of course, local and states have jurisdiction over, except for in federal lands themselves, and then on the state lands of the coastal areas, and then in this case, the Gulf of Mexico, or beyond that jurisdiction, which is the federal exclusive economic zone that will go out as far as 200 miles unless you run into another country, i.e. Cuba. And then typically the distance is separated and split in half. So we would have exclusive economic interest down toward Cuba for 50 miles, and they would have 50 miles toward us. And then certainly that's all associated with international treaties, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's international, but you're talking about things that are under federal protection, and that's where you would be, not you personally, but where the oil industry would be searching. So
in this case, what we're talking about, what's going on, we're talking about federal waters that would extend, that would start beyond 8 miles in the Gulf of Mexico, and then they go all the way across the Gulf of Mexico into that central and western Gulf as well.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you, what kind of timeline are you looking at? Because according to the Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, he told reporters that it's going to be a long process just deciding what areas are worthy of exploration. What do you expect as far as how long it's going to take to catalog these?
Well, what's very important to note is the process associated with oil and gas exploration has been in place since the late 50s. President Eisenhower and the Congress then created what's called the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. And what they did is they put in place an orderly system of leasing that federal offshore acreage in what's called a five-year plan. And that is what the president is talking about revising. The previous administration further limited and deleted huge portions of additional resources for production. The president wants to change that, and we've seen some announcements with his executive order. Then when he does that, the five-year plan starts to take place, And what has to happen is you have to do a very orderly process that has great opportunities for all kinds of involvement from a responsibility. First, a request for information, then draft proposed published ideas of where it is and a proposed program. So you're talking months and months of work there, then a proposed final program, and then you would announce a five-year leasing program. But before that is done and the actual leases occur, there's a call for information that has a comment period in it, and the defined sale area is announced, and a draft environmental impact statement for that area is published. And then you go on into an additional comment period with the final environmental impact statement provided, and then a proposed notice, both that have comment periods in there, and then it's sent to the state for their engagement, because the states have a say in the federal plan too. And then you have a final notice of sale produced with an additional comment period, and then finally, once all those hurdles are done, you have a sale held.
So how long does that take? I mean, we're talking about 10 years?
We're talking probably a large amount of time, more than a year before a sale. Now, it could be expedited by the president. This is typically what goes on with the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act that goes on. Of course, an executive order and the president's interest in expediting that for some of the other areas might take place. The administration has said they want to study the Eastern Gulf area more. And there are several factors that are involved in that before they would even announce a five-year leasing program associated with the Eastern Gulf. And that process that I just described will have to take place for the rest of the areas that are in the executive order. And let me just mention, that's just getting to the lease sale. I could spend another 2 or 3 minutes going through a post-lease and what has to happen also. Typically, historically, and you can't go, this isn't defined, typically from the time it's talked about till the first well in production is actually done, often takes as long as 7 years. That's kind of an average historic.
Okay, so it was between 5 and 10, so averaging around 7 years is what we're talking about.
Yeah, uh-huh.
So I wanted to turn now to Jacqueline Lopez with the Center for Biological Diversity. I mean, we all remember BP's catastrophe in the Gulf 7 years ago with Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And Mr. Michael was talking, he was talking a lot about the environmental impact studies that are done and the amount of time and applications and comment periods that go into even trying to put one of these rigs out there. Do you feel like the industry and federal oversight has made the advances that it needs to make in order for offshore oil drilling to be safer now than it was 7 to 10 years ago?
That's exactly a great point. So all the same safety assurances that Mr. Micah was describing with the different environmental reviews and opportunities for public comment were in place, and not much has changed since the Deepwater Horizon oil spill that let nearly 5 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico unabated for months and months. And that had billions of dollars of impact to the coastal economies. It killed and likely maimed thousands of birds, fish, crustaceans, all kinds of sea life and marine mammals, the effects of which we probably won't know for many decades to come. And so in addition to the environmental reviews really not having changed that much since the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, we have the additional crisis now that we've all become much more acutely aware of, which is climate change and sea level rise, of which Florida is on the front lines of. And so I'm down here in St. Petersburg, and on our coast, we're facing sea levels rising several feet by the end of this century. And we live in a state where we have a significant portion of our population that lives at or below sea level, and so at least within a few feet of sea level. And so with those impacts on the horizon, it just doesn't make any sense to jeopardize or sacrifice our vibrant environmental and ecotourism that we have here with the threat of opening up our near shore waters in the eastern Gulf of Mexico to oil drilling that will release additional greenhouse gas emissions and further contribute to climate change, especially when we have so much solar potential available in the state.
Yeah, I wanted to take that with David Micah. I know you couldn't hear what she said, but she was talking about really the impacts of when there is a spill. There is always that risk. But I wanted to ask, and what I was asking her as well, is have there been changes that have made that can avoid what happened before?
I think it's very important. I wish I could have heard her because I'm sure she raised some very good discussion points, and I don't want to shortchange her in any way about what was said. But let me just mention this. Since 2010, when Macondo occurred, and that was a disaster, and it was, most importantly, it cost us in the industry human lives. So first and foremost is in all our conversation consideration of the lives that were lost. And we've had to work very, very hard to improve our industry standards to help prevent that kind of event from ever occurring again. So first and foremost, on our mind, with the human lives at stake, as well as our environment, we must work on prevention, and we have done so. And since that incident, we've adopted at the American Petroleum Institute more than 100 new and revised exploration and production standards. They're available for folks to inspect. They're very technical in nature.
So the industry has, you're saying that the industry has made strides then to improve things.
Including standards on well design, blowout prevention equipment, subsea equipment, and worker safety. And all of our standards are accredited by the American National Standards Institute. And we've been publishing the industry standards for operation since 1924. And most of those standards are incorporated into federal regulations, not only here in the United States, but across the globe. Mm-hmm. Another important thing that has happened is our subsea well intervention capabilities have increased greatly with the creation of the Marine Well Containment Company and the Helix Well Containment Group. If a listener is very interested in this type of thing, there is a great deal of information available at the Center for Offshore Safety, all kind of grouped together, .org. And there's pages of information about preparedness and response associated with what's gone on since Macondo and what can be done there.
When you say Macondo, you're referring to the BP oil thing?
I am.
Okay. I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing. We're talking about oil and gas exploration in the Gulf of Mexico and how a new order from the Trump administration could open up the Gulf to new oil and gas exploration. Give us a call with your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And, David, Mike, I wanted to ask you, a lot of the discussion becomes an economic discussion. And there are people that say, yes, there is a lot of money to be made from the oil in the Gulf. But there's also a lot of money that is made regularly with tourism and with people visiting Florida. And when something bad does happen off the coast, it does have a huge impact dollars and cents wise. But to further that discussion, is it worth it? Is it worth spending the money to get the oil from out in the Gulf when there are alternative types of energies? And that's one thing that Jacqueline mentioned when you couldn't hear. She talked a little bit about there are solar energies and things like that are getting less and less expensive to do and to use. So how do you weigh those two different options?
Well, you mentioned a couple of different topics there. First, is it worth it as far as tourism versus the energy? They go hand in hand. Florida's tourism industry is driven literally by car, by plane, and by train. Everything that tourists do to get here and enjoy while they're here is driven by oil and gas. 70% of our electricity in the state is produced from clean burning natural gas. The environment is improved greatly as far as our carbon dioxide reductions in the atmosphere, significantly because of the changeover in electricity capacity from coal to natural gas. It's a lower carbon footprint. And then, in addition to that, when you talk about just money from that, the jobs that are created from the industry, it's estimated that 85,000 new Florida jobs would be created by 2035 if we are able to open up the Eastern Gulf of Mexico.
Now, what kind of jobs are those?
Induced employment, not all just working on an oil rig.
What kind of jobs are you talking about? Working on an oil rig? Or
no, absolutely not. Everything from university research to engineering to field, to labor forces associated with all sorts of technical capacity, computers, marine craft, a host of jobs across the sector in the private sector, as well as public research that has increased as well. And Florida is expected to be one of the states that could benefit the most by that, because spending would reach about $3.2 billion a year.
Yeah. So, and then, of course, you'd need human resources to oversee all of that, I would imagine, too. I want to shift gears here a little bit. Yeah. Well, I just wanted to make that clear because I don't know if anybody really talks about all of that. So, but I want to shift gears here, though, because Florida Senator Bill Nelson, he led a bipartisan effort in 2006. And it instituted a moratorium through 2022 for any oil and gas activity in the Eastern Gulf, primarily as a matter of national defense. He spoke about extending that ban on the Senate floor last week. Let's have a listen.
There has been a long-standing question of whether or not there would be drilling for oil in the Eastern Gulf of Mexico off of the state of Florida. The drilling off of Florida in the Eastern Gulf, everything east of a north-south line called the Military Mission Line, everything east of that is off limits in law to any kind of oil drilling activity, along with the remainder of the coast of Florida, 125 miles from the coast, going all the way over to Pensacola and to the Perdido River, which is the Alabama-Florida line. That area of the Gulf off of Florida is the largest testing and training area for the United States military in the world. Off of Naples, Florida, all the way west to the military mission line is approximately 250 miles. And that has been needed by our U.S. military because of the testing and training. Now, it has been doubted over the years as the relentless pursuit of oil drilling by the oil industry has tried to erode into that. If it's up to the Department of Defense, there will be no oil drilling activity. Two previous Secretaries of Defense in Republicans' administrations, including Secretary Rumsfeld, have written letters to state the policy that any oil-related activity in that testing and training range would be incompatible with the mission of the testing and training of the U.S. military. The Department of Defense cannot overstate the vital importance of maintaining this moratorium.
So, Jacqueline Lopez with the Center for Biological Diversity, how does an organization like yours respond to Senator Nelson's arguments about this moratorium in the Eastern Gulf being necessary because of national security concerns? Would you rather have military training or oil drilling?
We have no doubt that Senator Nelson shares the same values as we do, which is protecting the environment. In this instance, it also happens to be necessary for military preparedness. But the Eastern Gulf of Mexico serves the Florida Gulf Coast for much more than just that. And so there's no doubt in our mind that Senator Nelson is using every tool in his arsenal to protect our coast and shares our concern for the health of our environment, the health of our people, and the health of our economy.
Do you feel, Jacqueline, I want to ask you real quick, do you feel like there is any way for there to be oil drilling done safely? Is it because just the act of doing the oil drilling is unsafe, or do you think it's just because of the potential for disaster?
Oh, well, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And it actually begins much, much before the drilling. So with the Macondo well, the one that was responsible for Deepwater Horizon, that was actually an exploratory well, so it wasn't even actively drilling. But before you even get to exploratory drilling, you have to do seismic exploration. So on our coast, seismic exploration has not been permitted, but it is currently under consideration. And seismic exploration is the technique whereby these geophysical companies try to identify how much oil and gas is below the surface. And so they do this by towing air guns and blasting away 24/7 at intervals of seconds apart, and these have profound effects on marine wildlife. It's estimated that to open up this eastern Gulf of Mexico area to seismic would affect 31 million, there'd be 31 million instances of harassment of marine wildlife in just the lifespan of the seismic exploration. So before you even get to drilling, there are all sorts of problems associated with this dying industry operating in our eastern Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, and then I wanted to shift things over to David Mica with the Florida Petroleum Council. How do you respond to Senator Nelson's ideas of keeping the moratorium in place because of national security?
Well, national security is critical. And off of Florida's coast in the Gulf of Mexico, oil and gas operations have occurred historically. The military mission area is a critical area to our Department of Defense, who, by the way, is the largest user of oil and gas resources on the planet, the largest single user. So our national security depends on that resource. And contrary to Senator Nelson, I disagree completely. Historically, operations have worked compatibly with the Department of Defense, and the concept of what's called drilling windows, so that when they are not using a certain area, that area can be used for exploration, and then ultimately a subsea development can be accomplished and production of American energy that secures America, American security, provides American jobs, provides American revenues to promote our Defense Department and fund our Defense Department, as well as that that revenue to the jobs that are created as well. So you have energy, you have jobs, and you have revenues to government. Mm-hmm. That three-pronged stool is critical, and it is completely compatible with our military and defense interests. And we are delighted to be able to work with the Department of Defense, as we have in the past, to look for opportunities that we have. I wanted to also comment, because I believe you're, and I didn't hear it, but your comment about using other sources. Future energy demand is going to require more energy for the globe and for the United States as we go forward. Every piece of information from our government and reputable science that is out there tells us that we're going to need a great deal more oil and gas to go with our advances in the renewables that our industry is researching as well, in things such as solar and things such as wind and things such as biofuels, all advances that are beneficial. But when you look at quadrupling and beyond of those types of things, they're a small fraction of supply compared to our needs and requirements associated with oil and gas.
So you basically just answered my next question for me already, and that was, do you feel like maybe oil and gas could be a dying industry because of all of the new innovations with alternative energy? And as you just mentioned, the needs are going to exceed that. So
mix, Julia. Hydro energy,
we're going to need
biomass,
a mix.
Renewables, nuclear, natural gas, oil, and coal as well in some capacities where it can be cleaned and burned appropriately. So it's going to take an all-of-the-above approach. Florida needs to be a part of it for its own tourism industry to coexist at the same time while we protect our pristine environment that is critical to future generations and us as we are now.
And we have a call coming in from Cape Coral. Dale is on the phone. Well, Dale just left us. I think we just lost Dale. Sorry, Dale. We had hoped to get your phone. Are you there? Nope, no Dale. Well, I wanted to go to another piece of information from Senator Bill Nelson. He says, is there no disaster, no oil spill? Okay, is this better? I'm sorry, let's go to the other soundbite. This is kind of a summary, really, from Bill Nelson talking about why he wants to continue this moratorium.
We can't have oil drilling not only for our national security and our testing and training, but also we can't stand it if we had another oil spill that would do to us what the last one did, a spill way far west off of Louisiana, but it drifted to the east and it blackened the sugary white sands of Pensacola Beach, Destin Beach, and tarballs as far east as Panama City Beach. And because of that, we lost an entire season of our guest, our tourist, coming to the Gulf Coast of Florida, not just in the Florida Panhandle, but all the way south down the Gulf to Naples and to Marco Island. And therefore, a $60 billion a year tourism industry to Florida's economy, we can't suffer that kind of shock again. So whether it be the degradation of the environment, the messing up of the training and testing of our U.S. military in their largest testing and training range, or the economic devastating loss to Florida of its tourism industry, for all of those reasons, we need to pass this legislation.
So, David, Micah, I wanted to just get one last question to you. How would you respond to Senator Nelson's idea that Florida cannot endure another Deepwater Horizon? Because when you talked to people from the environmental world and from the tourism world, they're saying it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. How do you respond to that?
Well, first, it's important to note that while that incident was problematic to tourism that year actually rebounded and surpassed levels of the previous year overall in Florida. And I would say while it was certainly a challenge, and it was but it also represented an opportunity. I will also say that I think that some of the beaches that Senator Nelson mentioned were not impacted nearly to the degree of things west of us, and the media frenzy associated with that may have hurt tourism as well. And that was a very unfortunate part of the whole disaster that I think complicated matters as well. Certainly, as we talked about as the show began, it is important that we prevent this in the future and that we be able to respond better should a future incident occur. You need to remember that every day right now, from 15,000 to 30,000 people, a city of people are working off of Florida's coast in the Gulf of Mexico in the oil and gas industry offshore as we speak. They're Americans who have an ethic associated with the environment that is much like you and I, and they realize that we cannot afford to make mistakes, but we must move forward with domestic energy production, with using the best technologies that are available to mankind to not only look for this resource, but produce that in an environmentally responsible way. Exploration and development activities generally lead to increased resource estimates as well. It's important to look at, like, if you look at the last research that was done back in 1987 with some of the estimates of the Gulf of Mexico, they estimated only 9.7 billion barrels of oil were in the Gulf of Mexico. But with new data and with new production and new technologies out there, the estimates have risen to 48 billion barrels of oil, a five-fold increase in estimated resource potential to our country, to you and I, that we need to be able to extract in an environmentally responsible manner.
So, Jacqueline Lopez, I wanted to ask you one last question before we go because we've run out of time, but I wanted to get back with you about the environmental impacts of the BP oil spill. It cannot be really overstated and are still kind of not really known. What would another BP oil spill do to the environment here?
So we really know so little about the environment and about the species we have. In the Gulf of Mexico, we know we have over 15,000 different species of birds, fish, mollusks, marine mammals, crustaceans, all kinds of sea life, coral. And the Deepwater Horizon oil spill affected about half of them. And we won't know what those effects are for many, many generations. Likewise, we haven't ever had a massive spill on the eastern Gulf of Mexico area, and we don't know what effects that might have, but you can use your imagination and take the effects that hit Pensacola and parts of western Florida and move that oil spill 50 miles east and just imagine the devastation it would have on our coastlines. it's something that no one here wants to see that happen.
Well, with so much still unknown, do you feel like it's too fast to move forward?
There's never going to be a good time to move forward. And it's not just the environmentalists that are saying this. It's the Business Alliance for Protecting the Atlantic Coast. Now, granted, that represents the Atlantic Coast, but that makes up over 41,000 businesses and 500,000 commercial fishing families. And I guarantee you, if pressure continues to mobilize in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, you're going to see that same stand taken on the eastern shores, our eastern Gulf of Mexico, on our western shores of Florida, from our business communities, from our fishing communities, from the environmentalists, from the people that live on our coastline and value what we have. We have a good thing going here, and we do not need to put any of that at risk by opening up our coast to drilling.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I do want to thank our guests, David Mica with the Florida Petroleum Council and Jacqueline Lopez with the Center for Biological Diversity. Thank you both for joining the show. Coming up, after a year sitting on $300 million in settlement money from BP, state legislators have decided what to do with it. Up next, we'll talk with a reporter who's been covering the back and forth in Tallahassee over who gets what. I'm Julie Glenn, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.